Hello, thank you for joining me today. My name is Norman Baker. I was a government minister and an MP in Parliament for 18 years. And I'm an author of a couple of royal books, including the most recent one, Royal Mint's National Debt. And today I'm going to be talking with James Fairclough about the Duchy of Cornwall and how Prince William is making a huge amount of money, which should be going to public finances.
So to kick off, Norman, as you say, we're going to concentrate mainly on the Duchy of Cornwall. There's also the Duchy of Lancaster there too. So can you just give us a brief overview of what is a duchy and specifically what is the Duchy of Cornwall? Who's in charge of it?
Well, back in 1760, the deal that was reached with George III was that Crown lands would be transferred to the public sector in return for the government of the day taking over responsibility for funding the army, the civil service, customs, those sorts of things which a king previously had been funding, and also to give him an allowance every year called a civil list. That was a deal, and the government got the benefit of the crown lands, and that still remains the case today. The duchies, which are historical in anachronisms, have existed for hundreds of years before that, and they should have been transferred, in my view, with the crown lands to the public sector in 1760. But what happened was they were overlooked. Mainly, I think, because they were worthless at the time. They were just scraps of land. The Duchy of Lancaster produced a profit of less than £20 in 1760. So they were ignored. But of course, what's happened since is that they have become multi-million property developers, hugely profitable, and they give, therefore, a large sum of money to Charles, in the case of Duchy of Lancaster, as King, and Prince of Wales William, in the case of Duchy of Cornwall. And they insist, of course, that these lands are private. You'll have to call them private estates. But I have to say, it's a bit of a curiosity of a private estate, because they don't pay capital gains tax, they don't pay any other corporation tax or any other taxes which apply to private, genuinely private estates. They're also regulated by Acts of Parliament, which no other private estate would be. And indeed, in the case of Duchy of Cornwall, that was classified in Victorian times as both a government department and what was the phrase he used, an office of state. So, you know, it's nonsensical to call these things private estates. Clement Attlee, who became Labour Prime Minister, told the Commons that there was no way they were private and they should be wrapped up into the Crown Estate, which is a public body now, and I entirely agree with that. One other point to raise is that the royals were not allowed by statute to own private land before 1800. The Act came in 1800. So by definition, the duchies could not have been private estates before 1800. And there's been no Act of Parliament to transfer them into private ownership. And therefore, what's happened is the royals have simply annexed them through a process of kind of bureaucratic osmosis. And they say they are private. They're not private. They belong to the state. And we are being ripped off by Charles and William, who are pocketing millions every year that should be going to support our armed forces, our hospitals, our schools.
And let's just talk briefly about the scale. So the Duchy of Cornwall is 120,000 acres across 20 counties.
Yes.
And it's worth estimated at around £1 billion. So What income does it bring in? How much does William make from it? And how much tax does he pay?
Well, not enough is the answer. I mean, as you say, they own extensive amounts of land. The Duchy of Cornwall is not simply in Cornwall. In fact, it owns more land in Devon than it does in Cornwall. But it owns large parts of London, including, for example, the famous Oval Cricket Ground, which enables William, no doubt, to hit the taxpayer for six in terms of the money he takes from the profits on that. He takes a profit of about £23 million a year. That's about 150 times the salary of the Prime Minister for doing nothing. It's a royal slush fund, the Rupert Prefera's fruit machine, where every time he pulls a lever, he gets a jackpot out. Did he pay tax on it? Well, they didn't pay tax at all on these matters, neither the Duchy of Lancaster nor Duchy of Cornwall. The Queen before Charles and Charles when he was Duke of Cornwall didn't pay tax until 1993. They now say they pay it voluntarily. Thank you very much. I'm sure we'd all like to pay tax voluntarily. They don't declare officially what they pay as a rate, but the assumption is they pay what they should do in the rates applied. But William's been quite keen not to say how much he's paying. Charles used to say it when he was Duke of Cornwall, how much he was paying each year. And by looking at the income for the Duchy of Cornwall and how much Charles was paying, we could work out exactly how much he was putting aside for business expenses. I should just say, in terms of business expenses, some of the stuff he claimed was quite extraordinary in terms of what he was claiming for. Just refer to an article which I got in the mail on Sunday, last Sunday. His expenses, which he claimed against the Duchy of Cornwall when he was Duke of Cornwall, included 28 personal staff, butlers, valets, gardeners, and so on, and some expenditure for Camilla before they were even married, including her travel costs, jewellery, and stabling for her horses. So these are no way related to the organisation, the Duchy of Lancaster or Duchy of Cornwall. This is ridiculous for him to charge those. But apparently, HMRC, the tax arrangements in this country, have allowed him to do that. So now we know William has forced him to saying something against his will, I think, last week. And the Sunday Times reported he was paying $7 million in tax, which was a way of him saying, look how generous I am to the taxpayer. But hang on a minute. If he's earning $22.3 million profit or thereabouts from the Duchy of Cornwall, he should be paying 45% tax, top tax rate, on that money. Well, 7 million is not 45%, it's about 30%. So he's reduced his effective tax rate to about 30%. And he's done so, presumably, by allocating over £3 million, that's the difference between what he should be paying, what he is paying, £3 million in expenses. Now, what are those expenses? They are, for example, a wardrobe for Kate, for Princess Catherine, his wife. So she's getting a whole lot of designer clothes. She spent, 2012, we know, she spent £55,000 just in that 1 year alone on clothes, which was paid for, by the way, from the Duchy of Cornwall at the time, thanks to Charles. She's presumably still buying clothes. And here's a win-win for the royals, because she's getting clothes for nothing from the Duchy of Cornwall profit, although there's no reason that she should be funded from that at all. But that reduces the amount of money which is paid in tax because it's classified as a business expense. And what that means is that there's less money paid in tax to the Exchequer. So effectively, the public, the taxpayer, is paying for her designer clothes. That's just one element of what's being charged. But, you know, how can you run up a bill of over £3 million as business expenses? You can only do so, I think, if you're misapplying those expenses and including things which should not be included.
So, of course, as you mentioned there, the Duchy's been in the news recently, and perhaps one of the reasons that William was briefing in a kind of roundabout way, really, it was briefed to friendly journalists at the Sunday Times. But one of the reasons, perhaps, that he felt that he needed to come forward about it was the £1.5 million a year that Dartmoor Prison is paying in rent to the Duchy of Cornwall. So there's one example of an astonishingly good deal that the Duchy gets. But can you just take us through some other examples that maybe not as much money, but maybe even more egregious? So, for example, in the book, you have things like a scout hut that pays rent. You have a jetty that the lifeboats use. Can you just take us through some of the most egregious examples of where Prince William is profiting from essentially charities?
Yes, I mean, there's no shortage, I'm afraid. And the one I'm going to pick out here from my book on page 71 is about Plymouth Devonport, because there the Duchy of Cornwall, William, charges the Navy £10,000 a year just to be able to access its own oil depot to refuel its warships. And that's where Britain's Trident nuclear submarines are. And, of course, William is Commodore-in-Chief of the Submarine Service. So what you're seeing is, rather than helping the submarine service, he's actually ripping them off and making sure they pay money. Just charging the MOD for mooring boats at the Royal Naval College at Dartmouth, which is where he trained as a naval cadet. So not much in terms of recompense for them from that particular training exercise they carried out. Let me say, of course, that you mentioned Dartmoor. Dartmoor is a classic example, because what Dartmoor is... A deal over 21 years, I think it is, where there's a requirement for the Ministry of Justice to pay a very large rent just because a prison happens to be on Duchy soil. But beyond that, of course, the prison is empty. There's nobody in there because there's a radon gas issue. And also, as part of the agreement signed, the Duchy of Cornwall has required the Ministry of Justice to upgrade the prison. So they're spending money, hundreds of thousands of pounds, on upgrading a prison with nobody in it. Because that's part of the deal. I mean, this is absurd. They're also charging, perhaps the most egregious example, is that on Dartmoor again, the Duchy of Cornwall is charging the army to practice on Dartmoor. These are people who are fighting for king and country, and you have to pay for the privilege to the Prince of Wales. I mean, really, it's quite extraordinary. And this only came out because of some fantastic investigative journalism by Channel 4 and by, in fact, the Sunday Times, who went through a whole lot of property details to find this all out. Because, as we know, the royal family has largely exempted itself from freedom of information, and they think it would never come out. Well, it has come out, and it's deeply embarrassing. And I think many people across the country have seen this. That's woken them up and said, you know, this royal family is not beneficial to this country. It's not acting in a way that's selfless. It's acting to maximise its profits. And if you just look at what William's done since he came into the Duchy of Cornwall, taking over from his father, let's be quite clear. William is more mercenary about money than even his father is, and his father's pretty mercenary about money, because what he's done is reconstituted the Prince's Council, which runs the Duchy of Cornwall. Who's he brought on? He has brought on people who are investment bankers and property developers. So, you know, you look at the Duchy of Cornwall's annual report, there's a nice picture of the countryside on the front of it. You know, nothing to do with what his mindset is. His mindset is about maximising the profit for himself. He takes a very close interest on a weekly basis on what the Duchy of Cornwall board is doing and the duchy itself is doing. And although he's cut back on the number of royal duties he's been carrying out in public, he's not been cutting back on his investment time at the Duchy of Cornwall. His aim is to maximise a profit for himself from that duchy. And that, I'm afraid, is coming ahead of public duties for William. So, you know, people need to look at that with a hard nose. Also, you need to look at what they're doing with their investment bankers and their property developers. Look at what's happening in Faversham, for example, where they're proposing to build a huge number of houses on grade one agricultural land, contrary to what people locally want, because they want a lot more profit from housing, because the best crop for them is a crop of new housing. And this is following on from what his father did elsewhere in the country. They are big-time property developers, and they do so without having to pay corporation tax or capital gains tax. Look at some of the investments they've made over the years. They bought a warehouse in Milton Keynes because, although the front page of their reports shows some nice green bit of land, they've got some pretty horrible industrial buildings in the actual Cornwall portfolio. They bought that warehouse in Milton Keynes for £38 million. They sold it not long after for £61 million, a massive profit of £23 million. Anyone else would pay capital gains tax on that, the Treasury. The Duchy of Cornwall and Prince William and Charles before him doesn't.
And let's just talk about secrecy. So in your book, you mentioned, for example, that William was the first royal, presumably, and I think over a century, who did not declare his wedding gifts. And you also write in the book that he's very secretive about the duchy, even though Charles wasn't. Charles was more open. His grandmother was more open. So William seems, notwithstanding the recent briefing about the £7 million, to have really brought the shutters down and is arguably the most secretive heir in many, many decades. How do you think he gets away with that?
He is the most secretive. Charles wasn't open. He was more open than William, but he wasn't open. And actually, if you look at what was available from the Duchy of Lancaster, the Queen, Elizabeth II, who controlled that, was more open by some distance than Charles was about the Duchy of Cornwall. Duchy of Lancaster archives, for example, are in the National Archives. The Duchy of Cornwall archives are not available to people. They are private, apparently. Everything is private. That's a favourite word of the royals, private. They say they're open to requests for information, but there's a guy called John Kirkhope, who's a fantastic digger for information, Duchy of Cornwall, down in that part of the world. He asked for papers, to see papers from Duchy of Cornwall from 1832 and was told he couldn't see them. They were private. This is 200 years ago. They let nothing out. So how do they get away with it? The same way royals get away with it generally. They're exempt largely from freedom of information. They've managed to secure that over quite some time because the government's intention back in 2001, 2002, when I asked the relevant government minister about this, was that the royal family would be treated in the same way as any other part of the public sector. In other words, the same protections for personal privacy, but also in terms of what they're doing publicly for public duties and public money, they would be open to scrutiny. Well, that's never happened, or it's got worse, because Charles has lobbied when he was Prince of Wales, lobbied the government to change the rules. And now there's an absolute blanket exemption for Charles and William from freedom of information releases. Secondly, of course, the change to the civil list to sovereign grant has changed the way Parliament looks at these matters, or doesn't look at them anymore. There used to be regular annual debates about the civil list, which, of course, enabled people to raise matters about the Duchy of Cornwall if they wanted to do so. Those debates don't happen anymore. There's been no debate about royal finances in Parliament since 2011. This is extraordinary for a large amount of money. They're also costing us £500 million a year, and we're not discussing it in Parliament. That's extraordinary. So that's happened. Then, of course, in terms of the media, there's been, I'm afraid, a lot of the media hasn't either got the investigative journalism resource which they need to have, or alternatively, they're very happy to receive handouts from the royal family with nice pictures of Prince George when he's 10 or whatever they are, and put them in the papers, and that's royal coverage, and they don't ever look at the serious issues. That's changing a bit now. It's changing, I think, following that Channel 4 documentary. And they are becoming more interested, but they haven't up until now, because the royal family has wanted to bring down the shutters. They wanted to make sure that there's privileged access given to journalists who are favourable to them, and journalists who want to ask difficult questions, by and large, are not treated favourably. And if people pursue matters, then they're subject to legal action from the royals themselves. And an example I would give you was that when Charles was out shooting at Sandringham, because, of course, the royal family likes killing animals, they don't like people to know that, but they don't publicise it, but they do like that. That's one of their great activities. Prince Andrew, as he went, was referred to this shooting weekend, famously, on that BBC car crash interview with Emily Maitlis. People thought that was extraordinary, but, I mean, it's just normal business for them. But on a shooting weekend, Charles was out there shooting, and he was captured on camera by a member of the public. And he immediately phoned up the police. And the police came along and said, well, the man has no public footpath. He's entitled to take a picture of you if he wants to take a picture. Quite correct police response. The man was, I think, so incensed, he went to the Mail on Sunday to tell him the story. The next thing that happened was Charles's lawyers were threatening the Mail on Sunday with legal action to stop the story being published. Well, good on the Mail on Sunday, because he published it. And that's how we know about this story. But, you know, they try and control the news in a way that nobody else is able to do. If you go back to 30, 40 years, when there were royal interviews, for example, with Charles in his early days, he didn't give them very often, but they were genuine interviews. Mm. Now when he gets interviews, they are scripted. They have to agree the questions in advance he's going to be asked. You know, can you imagine agreeing to that if you were a politician? So it's Keir Starmer or Kevin Bedenock said, well, I'm only going to answer these questions. You have to ask these questions. I'll answer those, not other ones you want to ask. That's an impossible situation for a journalist to be in.
So you mentioned there the exemptions from the Freedom of Information Act, and that happened after Charles lobbied. So there was a long-running legal case for The Guardian, which was called, they were called the Black Spider letters. And essentially, in summary, it was all about Charles writing all sorts of letters to ministers. And the Black Spider is in reference to his handwriting. Now, when they actually came out, there wasn't really very much in them. And the only consequence afterwards is that Charles managed to then make the royals exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. So what I'd like to ask you next is, let's talk about the exemptions that the Duchy of Cornwall benefits from through Prince's consent. So firstly, just give a very brief overview of what Prince's consent is. And then can you just take us through some of the ways that the Duchy of Cornwall is quite literally above the law?
Yes, just to finish on the freedom of information point, you're quite right that Charles lobbied. And what the letters did reveal was Charles was lobbying on really highly political matters behind the scenes, in a way that was just quite inappropriate for someone who's supposed to be apolitical in his position. And rather than him saying, I'm sorry, I got that wrong, I shouldn't have done that, I overstepped the mark, his reaction was to say to the government, effectively, I want to carry on doing this, but no one must find out about it. That's effectively what happened. Now, in terms of Prince's consent, this is a constitutional outrage. We have Prince's consent and King's consent. Now, for those who don't understand these matters, and that's the 99% of the population, why would they? That's different from royal assent. Royal assent is a overhang from the past that is inoffensive, which is when a piece of legislation is passed by Parliament, it has to go to the King or the Queen, as depending who's on the throne, and they rubber stamp it and it becomes law. And that's never refused. The last time it was refused was about 1720 or 1730. That's uncontroversial. But that's not the same as king consent and princess consent. And what that is a process whereby, before legislation is brought to Parliament, before MPs even know the legislation exists in draft form, it is made available to either the king for king's consent or the Prince of Wales for princess consent, for them to comment on it and to tell the government of the day how it would affect their private interests. Their private interests. And that's happened by telephone conversations. A telephone conversation follows. Amendments are made to legislation before it's even presented to Parliament to take account of the private interests of the royal family. This happens hundreds of times on legislation. And we don't know what those conversations were because they're not relayed to MPs, but we know they occur. Then, of course, once the legislation's been changed, it is formally sent to the King, who then said, I've got no comment to make. And the same with the Prince of Wales. Well, they would say that, wouldn't they? Because already comments have been taken account of already, and legislation already changed. So it's dishonest to say they got no comment to make. They've made their comments and they've been incorporated. And I first found out about this when looking at the Animal Welfare Bill. I was sitting on the Bill Committee in 2006, I think it was, to find that the bill had provision for the RSPCA to be able to enter premises, private premises, where they believed animal abuse was occurring. But the bill excludes the private residences of the royal family, so Balmoral and Sandringham. That's a result of royal pressure. Now, I'm not suggesting, I don't think in a million years that people in Balmoral and Sandringham were abusing animals. Of course they weren't. But why were they included as an exemption in that act, became an act of Parliament? Why is Charles excluded, as Prince of Wales, and he was, from a piece of legislation relating to nuclear explosions? Does anyone think he's going to get his chemistry set out on Tintagel Castle? This is complete nonsense. But it's all there. And more insidiously, of course, they lobby for their private interests, where they're going to be money affected. Their money's going to be affected by whatever the government of the day wants to do. And we don't even know the lobbying or the details of what they're doing and lobbying on that. But we know how many times they've done it because the Guardian published those figures hundreds of times. This is an outrage. It's an outrage, actually, the King is asked. But at least the King is theoretically ahead of the country. And you could argue that he's got a constitutional position to uphold, although why it should affect his private property is another matter. But what on earth are we doing consulting the Prince of Wales? Legally speaking, the Prince of Wales is a subject of the King, as we all are. There's no more constitutional right for him to be there than there is for anybody else. So what's happening is we're consulting a private individual about his private interests and amending legislation to help him before Parliament even knows it's happened. That cannot be right. And the constitutional lawyers around the country say that could be changed in 5 minutes by a statement on the floor of the Commons by the relevant minister. Take 5 minutes and it would happen. So why don't successive governments, why has no government ended that ridiculous process?
So arguably Britain is one of the most feudal societies in the world. And one of the reasons for that is because of the leasehold system. So the duchies, for the reasons we've just discussed, prince's consent, the duchies are exempt from the Leasehold Reform Act of 1967. Do you think they'll also be exempted from the recent Leasehold Reform Act?
Well, you're quite right to say there was an exemption, and that's been a very sore bone of contention for people living in the Scilly Isles, for example, who've wanted to buy their property and been unable to do so. And they ask quite rightly and quite logically, why should we be prevented from buying our property in the same way as anybody else can anywhere else in the country? And why should the royal family privately, because they call it a private estate, be able to stop us doing that? In fact, just as a digression, it's not clear historically why the Isles of Scilly is included in the Duchy of Cornwall in any case. There's an argument that it shouldn't be there. That's a separate point. William, under pressure from the government, I think behind the scenes, the Labour government, has now changed his view so that two of the three areas which were exempt from leasehold reform have now been included. So he's given ground on that. But he still insists that the Isles of Scilly should not be included in the legislation. So again, here's what the royal family does, and William and Charles do in particular. They argue that they have a private estate. It suits them to call it private. But then they argue that they have the right to apply public benefit to themselves because they are King and Prince of Wales, and therefore they have the right to be exempt from legislation. You know, either they're private and they take all the pros and cons, or they're public and behave in that way. But what they do is they argue it's private when it suits them, and they argue it's public when it suits them.
So what is the significance of the upcoming Public Accounts Committee investigation into the Crown Estate? So as you mentioned in the book, in 2005, the Public Accounts Committee recommended that Charles not be involved with the management of the Duchy of Cornwall.
Yeah.
And he simply ignored them. What do you think could be the outcome or the consequences of this upcoming investigation? And do you think that also might be one of the reasons that William is throwing a few bones, as it were, to the Sunday Times?
Well, look, I mean, the 2005 Select Committee investigation was the first time that the Duchess had been looked at in any degree at all for a very long time. And they suggested that because the matters had changed, unchanged for 600 years, that perhaps it was time to look at it afresh, the sort of classic British understatement. But as you say, Charles ignored the consequences of the democratic decision-making process of the House of Commons committee. And it's interesting, actually, that the Queen, as was Queen Elizabeth, was much more hands-off on the Duchy of Lancaster, which had a government minister as a Chancellor of Duchy of Lancaster in the cabinet. By the way, what other private estate, inverted commas, had a government minister? She was much more hands-off about how that was run. Charles was much more hands-on with the Duchy of Cornwall, and William was even more hands-on than Charles was about the Duchy of Cornwall. Now, the investigation going on at the moment, the door has been opened on what is happening with the royal family to a degree. The Crown Estate, of course, is a public body, but it does have a relationship with the royal family in terms of what the royal family can demand from the Crown Estate in terms of properties. And in my book, as you know, James, there's a chapter called Houses of Windsor, which goes into extensive detail about all the various properties which they have across the country and indeed elsewhere, like Transylvania. So it's a very narrow inquiry which the relevant committee, the Public Accounts Committee, is looking at. And it's been generated by the fact that there was public outrage because Andrew and indeed Edward were being charged peppercorn rents for extremely large properties in Windsor Great Park, which, of course, was a loss to the taxpayer because the profits from the Crown Estate go to the Treasury, and therefore the Treasury is losing out because of the Crown Estate's charge is only a peppercorn rent rather than market rent. That's less money in terms of profit. So again, it's a subsidy, an indirect subsidy from the public to, in these cases, Andrew and to Edward. So that's what the inquiry is looking at. Now, I've made it plain to the Public Accounts Committee, I've written to the chairman, Sir Geoffrey Clinton Brown, that there should be a much wider inquiry into royal finances, not least of all because a sovereign grant is due for renewal this year. And it's an opportunity which should be taken by the Public Accounts Committee to look at public finances, to ask, for example, why the last year the civil list was 7.9 million for the royals, and this year the sovereign grants are 137.1 million. 7.9 to 137.1. Who else has had that level of inflation in the last 15 years? They should be looking at that. So they're looking at the Crown Estate only and that narrow issue of rents. But it needs to go far deeper than that. And I very much hope that the committee, through its membership, will conclude that there needs to be a much wider inquiry.
Because it should be a golden opportunity. There's three things going on that make this, in my opinion, a moment that the Labour government could grasp. So one is that public scrutiny of the royal family is the highest it's been in my lifetime. And it's pressure from social media. It's been pressure from heckling with Charles and Camilla and William, I think, forced them to act on Andrew, not least obviously the Epstein files. But it seems that in quite a medieval way, almost, the royal family respond to being shamed. So there's that in the air. We have a Labour government and we finally have the Public Accounts Committee looking into this after, as you say, an incredible joint effort by Channel 4 and the Sunday Times to shine a light on what's going on here. Do you think the Labour government will take that opportunity?
No, I'm afraid they won't. I mean, the Public Accounts Committee is cross-party, and we've got more chance of getting action out of them because these select committees do actually perform a very useful function in our democracy, and they do tend to act outside party interest to a large degree. So if the Public Accounts Committee comes forward with some recommendations, then it may be the government will feel they've got cover to do something. would act upon that. There's no guarantee that he would, but it gives them an excuse to do so. If the Public Accounts Committee isn't doing its work, as I think it should do, then you're asking the government to initiate change itself. And I imagine that the feeling in Downing Street is we've got enough on our plate without taking on royal finances at the same time. Best let sleeping dogs lie. So I don't have any confidence they'll do anything. And they've done nothing before when they've had big majorities under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. Gordon Brown was keener on taking action than Blair was, has to be said. But, you know, last time there was any real threat to change matters was about 1972, I think it was, when there was a select committee inquiry back then. Nothing much has happened in the intervening period. But, you know, they ought to, because the public mood is, I think, ahead of politicians. Politicians are wary about taking on the royal family. I think the public at large, my feeling is that they might want a monarchy. And that's probably where people are, just about, although the anti-monarchical feeling is much higher than it used to be. It's up to about 45% now of people who think they should be changed. But that's not reflected in Parliament. You've got 650 MPs. You can count on one hand the number of MPs who've come out and said something on the royal family or its finances. Some more have said things about Andrew, but even then, not that many have said things about him. And there seems to be a reluctance to take matters forward. You know, any one time, 20% of the population, at least, is Republican. Even the royal family is hugely popular. That's 150 MPs. Where are they?
So let's just end on the question of royal generosity. So from what I could find out, the last time a royal gave a gift to the nation in the terms of property or land was Edward VII, when he gave Osborne House to the nation. And I'm sure there are all sorts of taxings going on there, but that's the last example I can find of a royal saying, here's a huge house and here's a huge parcel of land. And of course, there's complexities about the royal parks, and I understand that too. But when it comes to George V, George VI, Queen Elizabeth II, and now King Charles, can you think of any examples of any of those monarchs in the last 100 years giving anything to the nation in respect of land or property?
Well, that's a tough question, isn't it? If I rack my brains, I think the answer is no, I can't think of anything that's been given. In fact, quite the reverse. It's been a one-way street of money and property and power, even. That's not quite right. Let me ask that question again. It's a tough question, James. I can't think of a single example where any monarch has given property or land to the public at large. It's a one-way street when it comes to money for the royal family. You know, take the coronation, for example, which costs at least 72 million. That's the official figure. And the campaign group Republic puts it much higher when you include cost of local councils and so on. Charles said that he was conscious of public accounts and worried about the cost to the public of these events. But he wouldn't pay any of it himself. He was asked if he wanted to contribute to the coronation. He said no. And of course, the coronation itself is completely unnecessary because no other country has a coronation in Europe. And the last coronation in Spain was, I think, 1470, I think it was. The last coronation full stop outside Britain was 1905, Norway. And Charles's coronation took place about, I think, was it a year after he inherited the throne from his mother? Certainly a large number of months. You know, did anyone think he wasn't king during that period? Because he became king as soon as his mother died. Or at the very least, in the next couple of days when the Privy Council met, which I was at the accession council. So the idea he needed the coronation was ludicrous. That was a PR exercise for the monarchy, and we were paying for it, and he wouldn't contribute to it. So that they don't contribute anything towards the public. They take from the public, they take and take and take, and in terms of money and property, they give nothing back.